because they have no clothes. Nor do they have any idea who they'll meet, where they'll live, or what they'll do once they arrive. They're easy to spot when they step off the plane, because most still have UN tags dangling from lanyards around their necks. After getting off the plane, America's newest guests walk awkwardly and tentatively toward the arrival terminal, busier people edging by them in the halls. Anxiety grows on their faces with each step. Then everything changes for them when they see Walter standing at the gate with his huge smile and arms stretched wide, reaching out towards them. Walter welcomes these beautiful people to their new lives. He treats them as if they were Jesus himself, because Walter knows Jesus, and Jesus said that the way Walter treats these people is the way he's treating him. Walter let me come along with him to the airport to greet some arriving refugees. I didn't know what to bring with me, so I brought a dozen helium balloons. Balloons are my go-to for everything where I don't know what to bring. I take them to birthday parties, job interviews, dentist appointments, bar exams, to the gym, everywhere except scuba diving. Balloons are an internationally understood code for celebration, joy, welcome, acceptance, and love. I think heaven might be a little like the greeting Walter gives to the refugees he meets at the airport. A celebration, a homecoming. None of us will need any luggage either. I'm expecting plenty of balloons when I get there. I can't lie. From what I've read, we'll get a chance to meet Jesus, and we'll have a discussion with him. It's not the kind of discussion somebody has when they get sent to the principal at school. It will be more of an uncovering, a revealing of what we didn't understand during our lives. For most of us, I bet it will involve a tremendous unlearning of many of the things we thought we were certain of. Jesus referred to sheep and goats when he talked about the discussion we'll have with him. He said we'll talk about how we treated people we came across during our lives and whether we treated them as if they were him. These are people like the ones Walter greets at the airport, the hungry, the thirsty, the strangers, people who are sick or don't have clothes, people under bridges and in jail cells. Jesus told his friends we'll all hear about the times we saw him during our lives but didn't recognize him and the couple of the times we did. I've got a long list of questions I want to talk to God about when we meet. For instance, I'd like to know how God decided where to put the waterfalls in Yosemite. Have you seen them? They're huge and majestic. I'd want to know about Half Dome, too. Where's the other half? Sadly, it seems that none of these questions on my list are the things Jesus will want to discuss with me. Jesus won't want to talk about our elections or impeachments. Who got the rose from a bachelor or who got the boot from a boss? What it seems he'll care about most is how we treated the people on the fringes of our lives. He'll want to talk about whether we gave them a hug or some much-needed help. All of this because he said if we did things for the lonely and hurting and isolated in the world, we were really doing it for him. I can hear how the discussion we'll have might go down. Wait, really? That was you? No way. The guy with all the tattooed cuss words? The hooker? The guy in jail? The kid in Uganda? The lawyer? The school teacher? The politician? The second group will be just as surprised by what they hear Jesus say. This group didn't intend to be mean or uncaring. They're a lot like me and you in this way. I'm sure they would have been more than willing to help Jesus if he'd asked them. But when the hungry or thirsty or sick or strange people came along, or when people without clothes came by, they didn't know what to do, so they didn't do anything. It wasn't that they disagreed with Jesus or folded their arms and refused to help. Their mistake was simple. In fact, it's the one I make almost every day. They just didn't recognize these people were actually Jesus. These people didn't dress like him or talk like him or act like him. In fact, the opposite was true. They lived in a way and did things that were quite opposite of how Jesus lived. Some of these things even landed them in jail or left them in perilous positions. Jesus knew this, and he said if we wanted to be with him, we'd stop playing it safe and go talk to them instead of talk about them. I've lived most of my life as a second group guy. I've simply been too busy or too good at keeping my distance from people I don't understand to know what they really needed. Sure, I noticed them, but I wasn't close enough to recognize it wasn't just hurting lonely people I was passing by, it was Jesus I was avoiding. Sadly, sometimes I only pretend to care for people who are hurting. The way I know this is simple. I don't do anything to help them. I'll say I'm too busy to help someone in need when it isn't time I lack, it's compassion. In short, I settle for merely hoping rather than actually helping. We all know people like Walter, people who seem to have all the time in the world for other people. The reason is simple. Walter thinks every needy person he meets is Jesus. People who are becoming love make this look easy. As a father, I know if somebody wants to do something nice for me, they do it for my kids. Good fathers are like that. When someone does something terrific for my kids, they don't even need to tell me. Fathers always seem to find out. Mothers know before it even happens. I bet that's how God feels too. Jesus said when we give away love freely to one another and meet the needs of poor and needy and isolated and hurting people, we're actually doing it for Him, even when we don't know we are. He said if we wanted to do something nice for God, we'd do it for His kids. And we don't need to make a big deal out of it either. He'll find out. Good fathers do. I've met a lot of people who say they're waiting on God to give them a plan for their lives. They talk about this plan like it's a treasure map God has folded up in His back pocket. Only pirates have those. People who want a reason to delay often wait for plans. People who are becoming love don't. It's almost as if Jesus knew we'd invent excuses under the guise of waiting for His plan, so He made it simple for us. He said His plan for all of us was we'd love Him and then find people who were hungry or thirsty or who feel like strangers or are sick or don't have clothes or are in prison or creep us out or are our enemies and go love them just like they were Him. Game, set, match. We can stop looking for another plan. That's it. Instead of just agreeing with Jesus, I started looking around my life for the kind of people Jesus said we'd be talking about when we finally meet Him on the other side of heaven's threshold. I was kind of hoping I could find just one guy who was hungry and thirsty and sick and strange and naked and in jail. This way I could get it all done at once. It doesn't work that way, though. I found out it's everybody. It's all of us in one way or another. It's me. It's you. It's the person next to you at the coffee shop right now. I know it's hard to believe, but they're Jesus, even the ones who look and act so differently than He did. Don't make this more complicated than it is. Just start. Go find someone who is hungry right now and do something about it. I've heard lots of people say that giving the poor a fishing pole is better than giving them a meal, but I don't see them giving away many fish or poles. We have a fast food place called In-N-Out Burger near our home. I'll buy 20 burgers and drive around town and ask people if they're hungry. If they are, I'll hook them up with a hamburger. I don't write little messages on the wrapper like, Jesus loves you. If you've ever had a double-double burger, you know He loves you. Find strange people and welcome them into your life. You may have a whole family full of them already. No one will even notice. Keep water bottles in your car and find thirsty people. Go to a hospital and find sick people and give away love and Band-Aids and maybe one of your kidneys. Naked people are a little harder to find, but we have a nude beach not far away. I stand at the top of the cliff and throw socks over the edge. Here's the point. Don't just agree with Jesus. Go visit jails and make a couple friends there. You don't need to commit a felony to get in. Just ask the warden. Do these things and you'll not only find your faith again, you'll find Jesus. Even better, you'll have plenty of things to talk to Him about for eternity in heaven. That's the plan. Chapter 18. What Grace Costs. Grace doesn't cost as much as I thought. These days I get a lot of telephone calls because I left my cell number in the back of almost a million copies of my last book, Love Does. Jesus was available to everyone, and I'm reminded of the power of engaging strangers as I feel dozens of calls from them daily. People don't follow vision, they follow availability. I don't send people to voicemail anymore. Try it for a week. Loving people the way Jesus did means living a life filled with constant interruptions. Take the calls, interrupt your days, be excessively available, and you'll be just like Jesus. There's a kid who calls me every 3 weeks and cusses at me. I'm a lawyer and thought I'd heard all the bad words before. Evidently, there's some new ones, because he's unloaded quite a few on me. The funny thing is, we've never gotten to what he's mad about. Each time before he hangs up, I tell him, I'll always take your call. Here's why. I don't want him to climb a tower with a rifle, or say these things to someone who just walked out of a biker bar. They'll kill him. I've got the young man tagged on caller ID as Vulgar Kid, because I need to brace myself each time before I get an earful from him. Is it fair he says mean things to me? Of course not. But here's what's changing in me. I don't want what's fair anymore. I want to be like Jesus. It's a distinction worth making. One day, I was in my office with a person who had some legal problems. The phone rang and I explained to the person who was with me, I never send people to voicemail. I excused myself and answered my phone. I was disappointed to hear a recording at the other end. Hello, you have a phone call from... I hung up. I didn't need any cooking knives or spot remover or the investment opportunity I was sure the recorded telemarketer was selling. I rejoined my meeting and started back in the conversation where I had left off. A few minutes later, the phone rang again. A little embarrassed, I excused myself for this next interruption, picked up the phone, and got the same recording. Hello, you have a call from... I figured this time I would just listen to the end of the recording and press the button telling them not to call me anymore. The recorded message continued. You have a call from the Sacramento State Penitentiary. Press 5 for your call, and you'll be charged $9.95 on your phone bill. Wait, what? I immediately pressed 5 several times. I wanted to see who I'd end up with. Who wouldn't, right? My pride had the conversation entirely figured out before it even started. No doubt there was some guy who'd been thrown in jail in Sacramento. I guess somebody probably gave him Love Does to read while he was locked up, and he was probably calling me to tell me he had read the book and what a great guy I was. I felt myself puff up with undeserved pride as someone picked up the line on the other end. Hello, this is Bob, I said as I waited for the accolades to start flowing. There was a pause, and then a man's stern voice broke through. Where's Shanice? Shoot, he wasn't even calling me. It was a wrong number. Deflated, I told the fellow Shanice wasn't there. It was just me, Bob. He gave a disappointed humph and hung up. I laughed at myself and my stupid pride and got back into my legal conversation. Then the phone rang again. Hello, you have a call from... You will be charged $9.95. I press 5. Hi, this is Bob. Will you call Shanice for me? Said the inmate. I started laughing. Buddy, I'd love to help you out, but I'm not sure how I could even do that for you. Then I remembered I could press a button on my phone and conference her into the call. Let me try to patch her in. What's her number? He gave it to me and I immediately understood how he'd misdialed me in the first place. Her number was almost identical to the number in the back of Love Does. I dialed the number. It rang a couple times before someone picked it up. But it wasn't Shanice. It was a guy. I wasn't trying to listen in, but it was a conference call, so I was already on the line. Where's Shanice? My jail friend asked. She's with me now, the other guy grunted, then hung up. I was so sad for my new friend in jail, but I could understand how complicated relationships can be and why people move on with their lives when someone they loved is away in jail for a long time. I hung up the phone, shook my head, and went back to work. And then the phone rang again. Hello, you have a call from... I pressed 5. Will you call my mother? I laughed. It was like I was this guy's concierge. You bet, friend. What's her number? I said, amused at how my day was turning out. I dialed the number he gave me. The phone rang a couple times, and while it was still just the two of us on the line, I told him I thought it was great he was calling his mom. On the 5th ring, his mom answered. They said a few things to each other, then my new friend said, Mom, I just wanted to call to let you know that I love you. She didn't say anything in response. She hung up on him. I welled up. It was just my jail friend and me on the phone again. I didn't know what to say, so I offered, Man, I'm so sorry that happened. That's gotta hurt. I was thinking perhaps he had tried to reach his girlfriend or mom because he was going to ask them for help. So I offered, Hey, what is it that you need anyway? There was another pause, as if he were deciding whether he trusted me enough to ask. Then my new friend sheepishly said, "I need a bracelet." I had thought of a long list of things he might have asked me for. A cake with a hacksaw in it, an alibi, breath mints, but I wouldn't have put money on him asking me for a bracelet. "You want to wear a bracelet?" I asked naively, as I tried to visualize this guy, sporting a gold wristband, covered in sequins, as he bench-pressed 350 pounds in the prison yard. "No, no. I've been in jail for 4 years, and I've qualified to be released with an ankle bracelet. I just need to pay for it." For those who are unfamiliar, an ankle bracelet is what the police put on people they want to keep track of as a condition of their release. Without missing a beat, I said, "Buddy, I'll buy it for you. What color do you want?" We both laughed, and he said they didn't come with colors, just locks. The next day, I got in touch with the prison so I could buy this guy an ankle bracelet. They told me how much it cost. I gasped and reached for my chest. I had the guy tell me the number again because I thought I had misheard him the first time. I had no idea how much it cost to lowjack a felon. But I made a promise, so I wrote the check. I assumed the guy got his bracelet because the prison said they released him a few days later. I haven't heard from him since, but I know he's got my number. Here's the thing. We don't need to put ankle bracelets on all the things we do for God like we're trying to keep track of them. In fact, he said to do just the opposite. Jesus talked about not letting one of your hands even know what the other is up to. There are probably a number of reasons he gave for this metaphor, but among them is when we do things for the poor or the sick or the strange or naked or those in jail, he already knows all about it because it's him. When I was in elementary school, we put on the classic play, Peter Pan. I tried out for the role of Peter, but I couldn't sing or dance or fly, so I didn't get it. Actually, I can fly, but don't tell anybody. I did get a part, though. My official title was Tree Number 4. I had no lines. I didn't even get a name, like Maple or Birch or Oak. My role was to just stand there, hold my arms out above my shoulders, wiggle my fingers, and look like a tree. There was no mention of my name in the program they handed out. There were no bouquets of roses given to me on the opening or closing night. I didn't get a backstage room with a star or a leaf on the door. And there was no cast party celebrating my performance. You know what? I loved it. Here's why. I knew what was needed. My role was clear, and it wasn't too complicated. In short, I knew what I was there to do. Many of us don't. Something changes for many of us after we've left elementary school. We try to make ourselves the hero or the victim of every story. Something goes wrong and we want to be the victim. Something goes right and we want to make ourselves the hero. It doesn't seem to matter which it is as long as we make it all about us. But if we make everything about us, it'll never be about Jesus. What I'm coming to realize is we're not the heroes and we're not the victims of all the stories happening around us. We're just tree number 4. I wasn't the hero for getting the guy an ankle bracelet, and I wasn't the victim because it cost me a bundle. I was just doing the kind of thing Jesus said people who are trying to become love do. I was just being tree 4 in the jail guy's life. Even when we do it right, often we don't land it right. Here's what I mean. Jesus knew some of us would be tempted to tell everyone who would listen about all the things we'd done. He talked about religious people standing on street corners, but he was really talking about guys like me. Maybe he was talking about you, too. He said if we made a big deal about what we'd done now, hoping to get someone to clap, we would have had our reward. We don't need to be the hero in everyone's story. Jesus already landed that part. When you do something for Jesus while he appears to be hungry or sick or thirsty or strange or naked or in jail, don't mess it up by making a big deal out of it. I once heard someone say, "If you want applause, join the circus. If you want to talk about it with Jesus forever, keep it quiet." When I told Sweet Maria about my jail friend, she thought I was nuts. Who knows? She's probably right. We both laughed at the thought we'd come home one day soon and see this guy wearing an ankle bracelet walking down the street carrying our flat screen. I kind of hope he doesn't, but it'll be a great story if he does. It should be the same for you. Go ahead and risk it. You're just tree number 4. You don't need a bunch of lines. Jesus is in the lead role, and he's got it handled. All you need are a couple arms to hold up in the air like branches and a few fingers to wiggle. I'm guessing my friend from jail went on to do terrific things with his life. But even if he didn't, I did. And it was because what I learned from him. He gave me one more thing to talk to Jesus about. Jesus doesn't need our help with the hungry or thirsty or sick or strange or naked or people in jails. I know this because I asked him. He wants our hearts. He lets us participate, if we're willing, so we'll learn more about how he feels about us and how he feels about the people we may have been avoiding. There's an amazing chaplain and a group of guys in a prison in Michigan, and another in Minnesota who teach me something about love every month or two. We exchange letters and have gone to visit them. Another group of prisoners started their own Bible-doing group. Many of them are in for life. They rack their minds about what they could do for others while they're imprisoned. They wiggled their fingers and used what they had. For $1.10, they can buy pairs of jail socks from the commissary. They mail them to me, and I've been giving them away for these guys. We may not be able to walk in their shoes, but we can walk in their socks. I think these guys understand a lot more about what Jesus was talking about than I ever have. Jesus' invitation to us wasn't complicated. He said, go find people who are hurting and lonely and isolated, the ones who look wrong or did wrong, and learn what your faith is all about from them. Did the people in our jails make big mistakes? You bet. Is it easy to see their biggest failures? Of course. I'm not sure why Jesus said we should visit people who had failed big like my friend with the bracelet, but I wonder if it's because he knew we'd fail too. When we get to heaven, I would have thought Jesus would want to talk about our terrific organizations or what nice people we were or the positions we held. Maybe these things will come up, but I doubt it. Instead, he said he will want to know how we treated the ones who had failed the worst. I get dozens of calls these days from jails all across the country, and I never refuse them. I think the prisoners are passing a Love Does book from cell to cell. Each time I get a call, I get a charge on my phone bill for $9.95. I don't take the calls because I'm looking for new friends. I do it because Jesus said we were supposed to, and I came to play, not to watch. In The Cost of Discipleship, Dietrich Bonhoeffer famously said, "We make grace cost too little." I once heard my friend Mike Foster say, "We make grace cost too much." Honestly, I don't know which it is. Maybe both of these guys are right. I haven't really tried to figure out what grace costs, but someday I know I'll get to talk to Jesus about it, and my guess is he'll tell me grace costs about $9.95. Chapter 19, My Bucket. How is your life working for the people around you? I've been asked quite a few times how my life is working for me. It's a fair question, I suppose. More than just small talks, what my friends really want to know is how things are going for me. I think a better question to ask is, how is your life working for the people around you? Because if our lives aren't working for the people around us, our lives aren't working for us. I have a friend whose home got toilet papered. It was an ecological disaster, kind of like the Charmin version of the Exxon Valdez. It was really an unbelievable job. Hundreds of rolls of toilet paper had been spread over the lawn and the shrubs. Someone must have been the quarterback for the local high school football team because there was toilet paper streamers hanging 100 feet long from the branches of the huge pine tree. I wondered how my friend would get the highest streamers down from the tree, and I learned a short time later he got a book of matches and lit the end of one of the long toilet paper strands. Bad idea. It was like a fuse. The flame leapfrogged up the toilet paper, catching every other intersecting strand on fire along the way. Within seconds, parts of the tree had caught on fire. One of the branches fell on the neighbor's garage roof, which was 3 feet deep in pine needles from the tree, and it caught on fire. My friend's life was not working for the people around him. How's your life working for the people who are closest to you? I'm always in a hurry. I put my socks on two at a time. I lace up my tennis shoes while I run to save a couple minutes. I order sushi at restaurants so I don't have to wait for them to cook the fish, and I don't even like sushi. When I'm not in a hurry, I spend my time being impatient. It's so extreme, sometimes I think I make coffee nervous. While living my life this way has been working out great for me, I started to wonder how it was working for the people around me. So I asked them, do you know what I found out? My impatience was driving them nuts. A few weeks after I asked the question, I found a beautiful kids' book that changed everything for me. It was a book about buckets, and its premise was simple. We will become in our lives what we put in our buckets. I knew I needed to fill mine with patience. I decided to put the book to the test, so I went to a hardware store and bought a metal bucket. I carried it with me everywhere for 3 weeks as an experiment. The bucket was made of galvanized aluminum, and it had a wire handle. I looked like a dairy farmer. I took my bucket with me in cars, on sailboats, in subways, everywhere. People on airplanes would ask if I had a bladder problem. Actually, I'd say jokingly, I do. But then I would say, I have an even bigger problem. I'm really impatient. I let them know how I use the bucket as a reminder to fill my life with patience every day. If we fill our buckets with a bunch of business deals, we'll turn into business people. If we fill them with arguments, we'll become lawyers. If we fill them with a critical spirit, we'll become cynics. If we fill them with joy, we'll experience tremendous happiness. I believed in the concept behind the bucket so wholeheartedly, I filled my bucket with sprinkled donuts one day just to see what would happen. Here's the simple message Jesus has for us. If we fill our buckets with love, we can actually become love. I have a friend named Randy Phillips. He's an amazing guy who pastors an even more amazing church called Life Austin. He also has a band called Phillips, Craig, and Dean. I know it sounds like a law firm, but it's not. Randy asked me to come speak at his church one Sunday. He had called me almost a year in advance and gave me the date for the Sunday service. I jumped at the chance to be with Randy. What I didn't realize until the weekend finally arrived was the date he picked was Super Bowl Sunday. I don't watch much football during the season. I'm too impatient. But I love watching the Super Bowl. Actually, what I really love is being with Sweet Maria and eating nachos. The Super Bowl gives me the excuse I need to do both. I don't spend very many nights away from Sweet Maria. It happens from time to time on an overseas trip. The rest of the time, she usually drops me off at the airport each morning at 5:30. She never asks me where I'm going, and I never think to tell her. I'll usually go somewhere for the day, and then I fly back home for a late supper. When someone asks her where I am, she always says the same thing. He's on his way home. Because I always am. There are nights I can't make it back, of course. We don't feel bad about it when it happens. We just try to have fewer of them. I'm a pretty energetic person, so traveling and being around a lot of people works for me. What works for Sweet Maria, however, is to have me home. Because she's there, being home works pretty great for me, too. So I don't think of all the reasons I'm not going to be at home. I just get there. I'll fly from Atlanta to San Diego for supper and back to the East Coast the next day. I've been doing this for years. I spent over 20 years commuting from San Diego to Seattle each morning, and I would make it back home for supper each night. Our kids were in junior high school before they knew. When they figured it out, they said, Dad, you said you work downtown. I do, I answered with a grin. They never asked me which city. I'm not trying to be efficient in the way I love Sweet Maria and our kids. I'm trying to be present. There's a big difference between the two. One thing I've learned from following Jesus is extravagant love is never wasted. Yours won't be either if you keep running home. When I finished speaking at the last of several services at Randy's church, I jumped into my rental car and bolted for the airport to get home for the last couple plays of the Super Bowl. It was going to be tight like usual. When I got to the rental car return lot, there were a couple of lines with an attendant in front of each. I chose my line and began waiting. Nothing happened for several minutes, so I craned my neck out the window to see what was the holdup. At the front of the line, an attendant was staring into the air as if he were trying to remember the words to a Rolling Stones song. I jiggled my foot on the brake impatiently. I tapped my fingers on the dashboard. After 5 minutes, I let out an audible, exasperated, "Really?" into my empty car. All the while, the next line to me was moving along just fine. I was more than a little peeved, I can't deny, as the cold realization sunk in, I got that guy. You know the one I'm talking about. The only gears he seemed to have were slow, stop, and reverse. I sat in my rental car, fingers still drumming on the steering wheel, waiting for him to gain consciousness. The car in front of me started to inch forward, but then it happened again. Entire seasons changed while I waited. I inched forward again. I was at the height of my frustration when I noticed my bucket in the passenger seat. I'd completely forgotten about it. Fill it with patience, I said to myself over and over. Fill it with patience. Finally, the attendant slowly lumbered towards me. I've seen glaciers move faster. He opened the door slowly and asked, "How was your rental car experience?" In the old days, I would have just clocked him with my bucket or made a wisecrack to let him know what a lousy job he was doing and how he made me miss my flight. Something different was going on inside me this time, though. For 25 minutes, I'd done my best to fill my bucket with patience. This time, instead of making the snarky remark that came to mind, I said to the guy as I got out of my car, "I had a great time. The car was awesome. You're awesome. Airplanes are awesome. Life is awesome. I hope you have a great day." I didn't even recognize myself. It was like a ventriloquist had his hand up my shirt and was making my mouth move and was saying things for me. This certainly didn't sound like the old version of Bob talking. And you know what? It wasn't. It was a bucket full of patience doing the talking. I had missed my plane by a lot. I got out of the car with my bucket and started walking to the terminal to book a new flight. I'd walked halfway across the parking lot when the rental car guy came running up from behind me and put his hand on my shoulder. A little winded, he said, "Hey, I just wanted you to know," he paused to catch his breath before continuing, "that was a great sermon you gave at church." "You were there?" I thought as I held back a gasp. Oh man, if he only knew what was going on in my head while I was sitting in line before I remembered my bucket in the passenger seat. We can pretend to have all the game we want to up on stage, in the pulpit, on the field, at work, or in our faith communities. But it's how we engage with a rental car attendant, or the grocery bagger, or the bank teller, or the person who puts on the car tires that lets everybody know where we really are with Jesus. I still get it wrong more than I get it right, but I was so grateful I had filled my bucket with the right stuff that day. All the words and emotions that otherwise would have spewed out of me would have shattered this guy and shown me for the impatient, selfish guy I'm still trying to put on the bus. People will figure out what we really believe by what we actually do. Everybody has a plan, but God is looking for people who know their purpose. As often as I try to make it look otherwise, most of the time I make everything about me. I make it about my schedule and my timing, how I'm feeling and how big a hurry I'm in. Kind of like Paul in the Bible. I talk a good game, but I find myself doing exactly what I said I wouldn't do and not doing what I said I would do. It's taken some time, but I'm starting to act like my purpose is to love God and to love the people around me the way Jesus loved the people around him. As much as I'd like to make it more complicated and have more steps so I can find some cover for my inaction, it's really that simple. Loving my neighbors, even when they're the punishingly slow car rental return guy, means I have to find a new way to engage them. To pull this off, I need to do it with an unreasonable amount of patience and kindness and understanding. We all encounter difficulties. It's what we do next that defines us. During the times when I'm confused, my feelings get hurt, or I'm exhausted or frustrated, I'm learning how to fill my bucket with love and acceptance. People don't grow where they're planted, they grow where they're loved. Knowing things about the Bible is terrific, but I'd trade in a dozen Bible studies for a bucket full of love and acceptance, and truth be told, so would everybody around us. While unloading on the rental guy the way I wanted to at first might have worked for me for a few moments as I let off some steam, the conversation wouldn't have worked for him. Because I had been filling my bucket with patience, I'm sure I had the conversation I should have had with the rental car guy that day. As a result, I let loose a lot of grace into the world. It's this simple and that difficult. The guy who is up in front at church needs to be the same guy in the back of the rental car line. If you can't do that, either stop driving or get off the stage. Bringing those two different people together is going to take a whole lifetime and a pretty big bucket. My daughter Lindsay is a teacher, One year, when she was teaching kindergarten, she told me she was working on report cards. Lindsay didn't give A's and B's and C's like I was used to in school. She gave the students different letters. For example, an M means they had mastered the curriculum. A G means they were at grade level. My favorite grade by far was for the students who hadn't quite wrapped their minds around an idea. Those kids got an N. Do you know what that stands for? Not yet. Isn't that beautiful? Jesus doesn't give any of us grades, and I'm grateful for that. He's the only one who ever loved people perfectly. None of us will ever get love and kindness or sacrifice entirely right. We're all just doing the best we can. While I've never tried to grade my faith, if I did, I think there would be quite a few areas where I'd give myself an N. As much as I wish it were otherwise, I'm just not quite there yet. What's sad is I'm not quite there on a number of the things Jesus said were the most important to him. For example, I get an N when it comes to loving the people who are well-intentioned, who make following Jesus feel like it's a homework assignment to be completed during weekend detention rather than a banquet with him. I'm not quite there with people who push others away from Jesus because of their behavior rather than drawing them in with love. This includes the one who expect to meet people at the finish line rather than realizing we're all at the starting line in our faith. I'm just not quite there yet on the way I deal with people who have frustrated me or who slow me down. I also get an N for being as loving and accepting of people I disagree with as God wants me to be. I don't love God with my whole heart and soul and mind yet, like he asked me to. I think I do, but then I see how I treat people who are different than me, and it often looks like a guy who's looking for a good deal in his faith rather than a guy who's sold out to it. All of this said, God doesn't measure things the way we do, and he doesn't grade us on a curve. The first step is to realize, even though we've got an N in him, he's over the moon about us anyway, and he'll help us to find the strength and courage to change. Jesus never had a problem with people who knew their shortcomings. He didn't tolerate people who faked it. Once we get real with where we actually are and our desperate need for him, he's got a person he can do something with. When I got home from Austin, I told Sweet Maria all about my trip and Randy's terrific church and the rental car guy. I told her how I sat in line and filled my bucket with patience. She nodded as I waved my arms, and she looked at me with a grin and a twinkle in her eye as I told her about how much progress I had made in being patient. When I was all done, I asked her what she thought about everything I was learning. With the sincerity of Mother Teresa and the wisdom of the ages, she leaned over to me and whispered, "Get a bigger bucket." As I think about it now, I realize I look pretty silly walking around with my bucket, but I probably look even sillier walking around with all of my pride and selfishness and impatience, even more so to the people who were closest to me, the ones my life wasn't working for. The same is probably true for you and the ones you love. Now, when I'm feeling overwhelmed by distractions or someone hurts my feelings or I'm feeling a little impatient, I grab my bucket. I still mess up more often than I want to. When I do, instead of beating myself up, wishing I were the guy who had it all figured out, I hear the gentle and kind voice of Jesus reminding me once again to stop laying sod where he's planting seed in my life. His reason is simple. He's more interested in making us grow than having us look finished. He wants me to realize I'm just not quite there yet. Chapter 20, Crock Drop. Let's go to our church. I received a call from a small church in Alabama, and they asked if I'd come speak at a gathering they were having. The guy who called me said the place they were meeting was located in a small town I hadn't heard of before. It was going to be a lot of travel to get there, so I asked him to tell me a little bit more about the event. "Well," he said with a terrific southern accent in a pause, "we're having a crock drop." "A crock drop?" I asked in amazement. "Yep," he said. "I'm in," I shot back. "What more information does a guy need?" I started rearranging everything I had on the calendar and bought a plane ticket. I felt like I had turned back into a junior high school kid who was about to take the tires off the principal's car. Growing up in Southern California, I'd never been to a croc drop before. I hadn't even seen a crocodile except on the Discovery Channel. I envisioned how terrific it was going to be when the crocodiles began falling like balloons from the ceiling when I walked in. Kind of like when a president gets elected, except the balloons would have big teeth and tails, and they'd look really dangerous until people made belts and shoes and luggage out of them. I wondered if the crocodiles bounced when they hit the ground, or if they just started biting people on the fly. These are important things to know. What does a guy wear to a croc drop anyway, I wondered. Camouflage? Body armor? Nothing at all? I wasn't sure. I arrived at the event and made my way to a huge warehouse where the croc drop was going to happen. I got to the door, puffed out my chest, took a deep breath, and I said out loud, "Bring it," as I opened the door and walked inside. It only took me a moment to realize I'd got something terribly wrong. This place wasn't filled with crocodiles, as I'd expected. It was filled with potatoes. Lots of potatoes. Thousands of them. It seemed all potatoes ever grown were in there. And lots of people, too. Not everybody in Alabama, but most of them. A youngish guy came up to me, thrust his hand out, and introduced himself as the guy who had invited me. I was still a little confused and kept glancing up at the ceiling. I didn't want to be rude, but after a couple awkward minutes of small talk, I drummed up the courage to ask him, "So, where are the crocodiles, and where do they drop from?" He looked at me for a second, half grinning, and cocked his head. "Crocodiles?" "Yeah," I said, "you know, for the croc drop." A huge grin grew over his face, and he exploded into a belly laugh. "This isn't a croc drop, it's a crop drop." "A crop drop?" I asked, more than a little disappointed. That would explain all the potatoes, but I still didn't get it. He told me there were a couple of fields just outside of town. When the crops get picked by machine, many of the potatoes are left on the ground afterwards. All the churches in the area gather together and glean the fields to get the potatoes the machines missed, and then bag them for the poor and hungry in the community. "We're all just bagging potatoes here. We want to make good use of what gets passed over." It was such a beautiful picture of what the church is and who we're supposed to be. Inside the warehouse, there were no name tags, no members, no separate identities, no building programs, no matching shirts, and no discussions about theology or who was right and who was wrong. It was just a bunch of people bagging passed over food to give away to people in the community who probably felt passed over too. People who are becoming love lose all the labels because they know they don't need them. The night before Jesus died, his prayer for us was that we would become one. He knew what it was like to be one with his Father, and he said he wanted that for us. It was a prayer for unity, not sameness. He knew the gospel wasn't a bunch of rules to obey. It was a person to follow and to be one with. He wanted us to live into the beautiful, unique creations God made us to be. Simply put, we can be one without being each other. The people in the warehouse that night didn't see themselves as a bunch of churches coming together to participate in a program. They were one church, living out its purpose. I bet if you asked them where they go to church, they'd point to everyone helping out and tell you they all go to our church. Our church is made up of people like you and me, whom Jesus didn't pass over just because we messed up. He didn't give us a membership, he gave us a message. It's the same message I saw carried that night by a bunch of people bagging potatoes in Alabama. They realized if following Jesus didn't lead them to the poor and the hungry and the isolated, then they weren't actually following Jesus. The story is literally as old as time. But God loved what he created in the universe so much, he made people to enjoy it. Perhaps we thought because God made us, we should make something nice for him in return, so we built him a bunch of buildings and started going to them on Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights. I love church buildings. I spend almost every weekend in one. The problem is, God said he didn't dwell in buildings made by men. Instead, we can find him in the people he made who want their lives to look like his. Does he use the buildings? You bet. Does he love it when we gather together and worship in them? Absolutely. Nothing delights him more. Does he need them? Not for a minute. He's got us, we've got him, and he's given us each other. It's been his plan from the beginning, Should we meet together as a community around Jesus? Yes, constantly. Where? Everywhere. You pick. He wants our hearts. He doesn't care about the address where it happens. I spoke to a guy once who said the church had hurt his feelings, so he was leaving it. I told him, "You can't leave the church. You are the church." That guy is part of our church. Your church is part of our church too. Even if you don't think you go to a church, you're part of our church. At our church, there's nothing to join, just Jesus. Where two or more people who follow Jesus go, the church goes. I get asked all the time, "Where do you go to church?" As you might imagine, my answer is always the same. I go to our church. I'm not trying to dodge the question when I say this. I'm trying to be accurate. I learned this at a crock drop. There's a pastor friend of mine who doesn't really have his own church. Instead, for years, he brought people together in his community from lots of different churches. He just wanted them to be one the way Jesus told his Father he wanted us to be one. There were a couple thousand people who came every month or two, and my friend asked me to speak at one of the gatherings. They didn't really need a name for what they were doing. They're ordinary folks, like you and me, who think it's enough just to be together, give thanks to God, and leave all the names and labels and distractions behind. Sadly, I received a call from my friend a couple days before I came to speak. He told me that he just received word that his son, who was 8 at the time, had been diagnosed with leukemia. There's no good version of the disease, but his son got a bad version. "Oh no, should we cancel the event?" I asked into the heavy phone in my hand. He told me, "No, honestly, I need to be around people this week more than ever." I flew out a few days later and was blown away by the unity this group had developed over their years together. As I finished my talk, I saw my friend sitting in the front row looking at the floor. It's a tradition in some faith communities to lay hands on someone who is hurting. It wasn't part of my faith tradition, and if you haven't seen this done before, it's not a big mystical thing. It's just a way to show support and love and community. I was thinking about doing that, but honestly, it would just be the two guys next to him and the three people behind him touching him, and the people in row 50 would just be touching the people in row 49. Then I had an idea. What if we crowd surfed him? My friend looked a little surprised when I asked everyone to stand up. I asked four strong guys to hoist him up over their heads and told everyone, instead of symbolically laying hands on him, we are going to actually lay hands on him while we crowd surfed him. Before I was finished getting the sentence out, they already had my friend in the air and had passed him a few rows back. He laid back with his arms outstretched for the next half hour as thousands of hands were laid on him. He was a guy wrapped in agony and enveloped in love. This is who we are and what we were made to do as a community. That's our church. We don't need to just talk about lifting others up in prayer when they're hurting. Actually lift one another up instead. I don't mean this as a metaphor. Seriously, walk up behind somebody who is hurting and lift them right off the ground. Don't be creepy about it, but do it. You won't need to tell them you're praying for them. They'll know. If you're wondering where Jesus' friends are, just find people whose feet are a foot off the ground because someone else is lifting them up. You just found our church. Sometimes we make church a lot more complicated than Jesus meant for it to be. When I was young, there was a rhyme that went, "Here is the church, and here is the steeple. Open the doors and see all the people." I would weave my fingers together with my pointer fingers touching to make the steeple. With my palms open, I would wiggle all the people in the church. I bet you've done the same thing a couple of times. It was just an amusing rhyme then, but it means a lot more to me now. What I saw when I was young was a church wide open in my palms. All the wiggling fingers were pointing out towards the world. What a huge turnoff to the world it is when it sees under the steeple a lot of fingers pointing at each other. Every time we go to church and point fingers at each other, we betray Jesus with another kiss. At our church, we go there to meet him, not critique each other. God calls the church his bride. It's a beautiful metaphor, full of love and anticipation and commitment. Have you ever gone to a wedding where the bride walked in and a guy in row 4 held up a card with a 7 on it, like they do in the Olympics, whispering to the person next to him, "I've seen better." Of course not. The bride steals the show, every time. Do you know what makes the bride look terrific? It's not the fancy dress, nor the building, nor the flowers, nor the music. Those things are great, but what makes the bride look terrific is everyone in the room knows the groom chose her to be his, and she's chosen him to be hers. The two of them can't wait to spend forever together. I think this is the reason why God calls us his bride. This picture of the church helps me understand some of the most difficult questions I've had about how God sees all of us. It's pretty easy to understand, really. God loves us, and he wants to spend forever together. We're his bride. He doesn't see all our flaws. He just sees us. God doesn't hold up a scorecard as we walk by either. He sees Jesus. It's that simple. The way our church will return to the loving and accepting place the Bible talks about is by us keeping our eyes on the groom instead of one another. We can put all the scorecards away. Perhaps if we spend a little more time looking at the groom, we'd start seeing ourselves the way he does. To God, we look just terrific. Does our church have problems? You bet. But he continues to pick us to spread his love to the world. I'm not sure why. To be honest, I wouldn't have. But he said he picked us, and that's all I need to know to be part of the celebration. We're the bride of Christ, not because of what we look like, but because of who we are trying to act like. That's our church. Chapter 21. Be not afraid. When you have all the power, you don't need all the words. Our family has spent a lot of time in Africa. My son-in-law, John, is an engineer and a hydrologist and has spent years building underground dams in Mozambique. Lindsay now goes with him there. Maria, Richard, Ashley, and Adam have all traveled to Africa as well. When I first arrived in Uganda in 2001, the country was still in the middle of a 25-year civil war, fueled by Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. I knew almost no one there. I had originally gone to Uganda to help friends whose nonprofit had gotten into some trouble with one of their projects. While I was there, I began wondering if I could be helpful to this country in some small way. I'm a pretty good lawyer, and knowing God often uses what we're good at to guide us into what we do next, I headed for the courthouse. Maybe I could find someone there who would let me know how I could help. When I got to the courthouse, there were soldiers with machine guns at all the entrances and exits. A trial was underway against some of the president's political opponents who had been charged with treason. This was a capital crime, and it added to an already tense time for the country. The last time a trial took place for treason, under the former leader Idi Amin, it resulted in 15 deaths by firing squad. That was years earlier, but no one knew how this one would turn out. I saw an official-looking office with more men and machine guns around it than any of the others, so I headed there, figuring someone important must be behind the doors. I inched past the soldiers, checking the safeties on their machine guns as I passed, and entered the office through a large door. Behind a big wooden desk was a pleasant woman who asked how she could help me. Not knowing whose office it was, I simply asked if I could see the judge. "Do you have an appointment?" "Not really," I said, staring at my shoes, "but I've come 18,000 miles to get here." "Just one moment," she said as she rose from her desk and disappeared behind another pair of huge doors. She came back a few moments later and said, "The judge will see you now." I hid my surprise and walked past her through the door, trying to look confident and lawyerly. The judge was sitting behind a massive desk, writing something, and didn't look up as I entered. When he did look up, he rose and gestured with his hand towards a seat. The proper greeting for a judge in Uganda is, "My Lord." Saying this takes a little getting used to at first. Where I was raised, this is reserved for the guys in the Book of Psalms talking to God. In San Diego, we're also more likely to call somebody dude than Lord. But I had practiced in the mirror that morning until I had it, so I was ready. The judge asked why I was in Uganda, and I told him I was a lawyer, and the only qualifications I had were that I loved justice, I loved people, and wanted to find a place I could help. We talked about his kids and my kids and hope, and how Ugandan courts had been closed in the northern half of the country for more than a decade while the Civil War raged. As our time was wrapping up, we both stood up. I came around the desk and gave him a big hug. I think he was a little taken aback. I told him I was a hugger. He told me he wasn't, and this was actually the reason he has guys with machine guns guarding his office. I took out my key ring, slipped off the key to the front door to our house, and gave it to him. I had my first friend in Uganda. It turns out this was no ordinary judge. This was the Chief Justice of Uganda's Supreme Court. That would explain the machine guns. He had written Uganda's constitution when they declared independence from Britain, and he was the second most powerful man in the country. Sometimes we wait for permission or a plan or a calling or a mystical sign from God before we get started. It could work that way, I suppose. What I found, though, is when we're looking for a plan, God often sends us a friend. I've been an adjunct professor at Pepperdine's Law School for quite a few years. Some people find it hard to imagine me teaching at one of our country's top law schools. I know, me too. My first year there, I thought I needed to play the part and act very scholarly. You know, smoke a pipe, wear a sweater vest, and run my fingers through my beard, that kind of stuff. Now on the first day of class, I just wave my arms over my head and tell everybody, "You're going to pass the bar exam." The class I teach is on failure. Each week, I bring in one of my friends who has screwed up in front of pretty much all the people on earth. Having failed big at least a couple of times is almost a requirement to be my friend. Otherwise, we won't have much in common. The objective of the class is simple. I don't want these young lawyers to think they're winners because they happen to win a case, or losers because they happen to lose one. I want them to know they're participants because they tried. They're just tree number four. I brought Jason, one of my good friends, into class. He made one of the most viral videos in the history of the internet. He's bright and engaging and sensitive and endlessly creative. In less than a week, his video was downloaded over 1 million times. On the morning of the 11th day, after 100 million people had seen the video, he invited me over to his house. We were sitting on the kitchen floor pounding waffles when something inside of him snapped, and he ripped off all of his clothes. I held on to him in an attempt to keep the party inside, but he got away. He ran outside and melted down on TMZ in front of millions of people. Mercifully, nobody knew I was the guy holding his boxers, trying to get him back into them. My friend had made a mistake prompted by something far beyond his control. Here's the important thing I learned from him. He doesn't think he's still naked on the corner. Many of us think of our big mistakes as disqualifying us. God sees them as preparing us. Jason is still as creative as he is courageous, and with guts and grit, he sees the bright hope his future offers the world. He's dreaming, inventing, and exploring again. He's learning and giving away hope and joy again. In a word, he sees what most of us don't. He sees who he's becoming, and this is it. He's becoming love. Sometimes God uses the most difficult things in our lives to show us the most accurate things about our lives, if we have the guts to receive a little grace. They say if you're an adjunct professor at Pepperdine, you need to have office hours, but they don't say where. I have mine on Tom Sawyer Island at Disneyland, every Wednesday from 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. I tell the students at Pepperdine if they have a question and $95, they should come and see me. I'm willing to bet I'm the only guy at the Magic Kingdom with a laptop and a stack of papers to grade. What's kind of funny is there have only been a handful of times when I've gone to my office on Tom Sawyer Island and had fewer than 10 people waiting for me. There are plenty of places I could go to meet people, I suppose. Pepperdine's law school has a bunch of conference rooms. I've even heard there's an office I can use, but I've never gone. I meet people at Disneyland because where we meet shapes the discussions we'll have. We've all experienced this, but few of us have put this idea into practice when we're setting our meetings. It's not silly to meet on a set of swings or a movie set, at a park or an airport.